Good morning. Basically, this is an appeal that was filed by my client, Joseph Scalia, involving a dismissal of an action in Superior Court. And basically, there's two claims involved. And the first issue, I guess, is whether this action was a mental health care negligent lawsuit and whether the 18 Delaware Code 6853 come into play as far as a merit of affidavit. It is our position that it was not a healthcare negligent lawsuit, that this case involved a custody dispute in family court where basically the party, well, my client was the father, there was the mother, and they were involved in the two minor children. The court ordered an independent custody evaluation, and that was done by Dr. Romorowski, the defendant.
Would you characterize the development of that opinion as rendering a professional service?
I believe he rendered a professional service, yes.
Does the statute, by definition, cover the rendering of professional services in order to assist in defining what constitutes health care service?
Well, it does to a degree as far as it talks about health care service and professional services, but in the definitions.
Well, it says or, doesn't it?
Or, exactly.
Not and.
But it also defines healthcare in 6801.
Okay.
And it defines healthcare in 6801 as to mean any act or treatment performed or furnished, or which should have been performed or furnished by any healthcare provider for or to the benefit of a patient during the patient's mental care, treatment, or confinement. It also defines basically in the answering brief that was filed by Dr. Romorowski, talks basically as far as the definition, as far as the mental negligence, and it talks in his statement that it deals with patient. And the section 6801 defines patient as well, as it in subtitle 8 says patient means a natural person who receives or should have received health care from a licensed health care provider under a contract expressed or implied. Well, it's clear that Mr. Scalia was not a patient of Dr. Romorowski, did not receive any treatment from Dr. Romorowski, was not involved in any doctor-patient relationship. And if you look at the definitions and the extent of what 18 Delaware Code 6853 means, and our belief is, or our argument is that it means that there is a doctor-patient relationship, that the doctor is treating the patient for some ailment, and there's a problem.
All right, so you would say that that's a predicate to the application of the term professional services.
Right, there's two predicates. One, that he's a professional or a healthcare provider, which we argue he is, and that he's providing healthcare services. And I think on the second part, if that's the issue, he's not providing healthcare services. He's providing an evaluation on a child custody evaluation. That could be done by, I mean, I guess, anybody in a sense. It doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor or a psychologist.
Well, Mr. Romero, let me ask you a hypothetical question. You're putting a lot of emphasis on the fact that this was an independent examination. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So let's suppose it's a workman's compensation case where someone broke their arm on the job, and they're sent for an independent examination, and the independent orthopedic surgeon has an X-ray that clearly shows a broken arm, but that person says, no broken arm. And then the individual goes to pursue a claim, and the board or the court says, we're going with the independent opinion that there's no broken arm. But clearly the X-ray showed there was a broken arm. And later it comes out that the independent examiner just made a mistake. What's the theory of recovery? Does the claimant have any recovery against this person who said there was no broken arm?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he basically has recovered for negligence. I don't think it's a healthcare negligent claim because basically he was not a patient of that doctor. But basically he would not be required to get an expert to come in and say he made a mistake because he said it wasn't a broken arm when clearly it is a broken arm. And I think the section in the code talks about that in general, because 18 Delaware Code 6853 talks about issues where you don't really need it. Something that's obvious if they take out a wrong body part, if they basically leave something in the body as far as during surgery. So there's certain requirements that are there that come into play with that. In Your Honor's case, I don't think it would be bar at all from this. I think he'd file a negligent case, whether you classify it as malpractice or not. It's a negligent case. It doesn't come into play because basically he was never a patient of that doctor. It was an independent medical examination.
I know, but when you frame the negligence case, whether it's ordinary negligence or it's professional negligence, we need to identify some duty. And I'm trying to understand the logical implication of ruling in your favor in this case if it turns on whatever relationship is created by an independent examination. And your position seems to be the relationship is simply not a patient relationship, and you're not acting as a healthcare provider when you're performing an independent exam. Is that right?
In this case, and the case that Your Honor cited, it's you're not providing a healthcare providing lawsuit because you're not a patient-doctor relationship. If I go to a doctor, and basically nowadays doctors do a number of things, but for some reason, whatever, I went to a doctor, and he also does tattooing or whatever, and he puts a tattoo on my arm. Under their theory, as far as Mr. Turner's line, if I filed a suit against him, then basically it wouldn't matter what I was there for. He's a doctor, so therefore I would need an expert to say that he's made some type of mistake. If I hired a medical expert to testify in court, and that he didn't show up, I paid him $5,000, whatever I paid him, he doesn't come to court, and I sue him to get my money back, under their theory, I would have to get an affidavit from saying that's negligent for him not to show up when it's obviously clear. So there are certain things that doctors do that are not done through the profession and not done especially as contemplated in 18 Delaware Code 6853. And I think basically that is that he's a healthcare provider and he's providing healthcare services to a patient or to his patient, as the definition talks about, and I think the code in general talks about.
Well, now I'm a bit confused. You said a patient or his patient. I thought one of the distinctions you were trying to make is if the individual had to be a patient of that provider.
That's correct. Well, I misspoke. His patient, I guess.
Okay.
And I think that's what, in our view, is the distinction. So I don't think this case in general was a medical negligent lawsuit, and therefore it shouldn't be dismissed.
What is the prothonotary supposed to do when a lawsuit is filed that appears to be on the surface of a negligence case against the healthcare provider if there's no affidavit accompanying the complaint? What's supposed to happen?
Well, I think in theory from the statute what's supposed to happen is that basically that is taken, then it's filed to the other side, it's given to the other side. They have, and in this case they did that, or at least they tried to do that, they filed a motion to dismiss because it wasn't attached with an affidavit of merit.
So the proprietary is supposed to accept it, whether it's accompanied by an affidavit or not.
I believe so, and I believe that they have an option to file a motion, which they did in this case. And apparently what happened was that LexisNexis or proprietary rejected it because there was none filed, and then nothing happened, proceeded to discovery, and then it was filed later on. At that point in time, the code itself allows basically somebody 60 days to bring an affidavit if there's a problem. In this case, we couldn't do that because so much time has lapsed. So if an action is filed, there's no affidavit, the other side files a motion to dismiss, it goes in front of the court determines that there should be an affidavit, then in theory, it's allowed to have 60 days to provide one.
So you're saying it's not a jurisdictional requirement, it's a defense that can be waived, that is the absence of an affidavit, is that right?
I guess if they did not file an action and they don't bring it the date of trial, they can't say you didn't file it. And I think the argument is that you waive that argument.
This is a medical malpractice action, correct? That was the form that it took.
Yeah, it was a malpractice case.
Okay, and medical malpractice actions, as a general matter, are governed by the medical malpractice statute.
In a general manner, I agree with that.
And this one would be, too.
If it complied with all the other terms.
So your position is, although the statute as a whole applies, there's one provision of the statute that doesn't?
Well, I'm not sure I'm saying one provision or statute. I'm saying before the statute can apply, it has to be a health care provider, and it has to be providing health care services.
So you're saying the statute doesn't apply. It's a medical malpractice action that falls outside the statute that governs medical malpractice actions generally?
Under this fact scenario, yes, it would not apply.
So none of the provisions of the statute apply.
In this action, what we have here,
we're talking about this action.
Right, I don't think it would apply because it's
none of, none of the requirements of the medical malpractice action would apply.
None of the requirements under 18 Delaware Code 6853. Yes.
All right.
And the second issue is the recusal. If Your Honor wants to deal with it, or I don't really have that much to say. My only issue involved in that is that basically. What happened, I guess, with Judge Tolliver and myself, and in the action which I submitted in the appendix, and that happened, I guess, on May the 22nd of 2008, in a related case with his transcript, where the court had recused itself. He basically indicated that the court doesn't intend to handle it, Mr. Muno. I can't, by my own directive, handle any matters involving you. The record should reflect because you have threatened my spouse. I believe that leaves us in a very awkward position, and I would not want to test the court's fairness or what I believe is my fairness and sentence or take a plea or otherwise handle your matters, given the communications you have directed to my home.
Now, during that period of time, did Judge Tolliver recuse himself from only your cases or from cases involving everyone in your law firm?
I'm just myself in my law firm, so he has recused himself from my case, but he also recused himself from handling Norm Levin's case, which represented his spouse's ex, I think is the definition. So he had, and he, I think he's still recusing himself in Mr. Levin's cases, but he doesn't do that much superior court action, so it's not that much of a need. So, I mean, that was said on the record in May of 08, in July, or whenever he denied the motion, you know, he says it's not an issue anymore. But it's an issue in a sense that he made that statement and he believes that I threatened his spouse. Whatever, but certainly there's an appearance of impropriety.
Well, when you say there's an appearance of impropriety, is that the legal test? Or whether a judge should recuse him?
Well, I guess there's two standards. There's basically a subjective and an objective test.
And isn't it correct that Judge Tolliver did that subjective analysis first, then an objective analysis, and ruled on the record why he denied your motion to recuse?
I'm not sure he made an objective announcement. I mean, I guess one of his positions was is that it's a small bar. We don't see ourselves that often. And therefore, I don't see any need to recuse myself. On the same token, he had continued to recuse himself up to this period of time. And I guess Weber's decision in State versus Weber came out by this court on April the 22nd of 09. At that point in time, he basically was trying to take that case back. I filed a motion with the court, basically re-argument, saying that I'm told that Judge Tolliver is taking it, and I would ask to argue so we can recuse him. I think this court basically denied that motion, saying it was moot, and therefore he never had the case. It went back to the carpenter. So that was going on at the same time. So I don't think that once he makes a statement on the record and says that I threatened his spouse, I think that's a serious enough allegation that I shouldn't be put and my client shouldn't be put in that awkward position to see if, in fact, he takes it out against me or my client.
Was everything resolved between May and July?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You said that there was a letter in May, and in July, Judge Tolliver said everything was resolved. Is that correct?
In May of 08, on the record, he says, you threatened my spouse.
Right.
I'm not going to handle your case. This puts me in an awkward position. When we filed the motion, I guess, in July,
Of 09. So it's 15 months later.
Yeah, well, whatever
okay.
the period is.
Now, why would he continue to disqualify himself in Mr. Levin's cases and not yours?
Well, in family court matters, things continue on until the children are 18. They're not 18 at this point in time, so presumably if other matters come up, then, you know, he's going to continue to represent Mr. Woolley, who is the person involved.
Okay. Thank you.
You want to save the balance of your time?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
May it please the court. I think, Chief Justice, your case falls within the statutory exception for expert witnesses. I was distressed to see that you're missing your right hand. And it would appear there's been an operation on the wrong body part. Perhaps I'd not understand.
What, I need brain surgery? Is that what you're trying to say?
I assume you do have an arm under the ropes.
Mr. Mason, can you start with the hypothetical that I asked and tell me how that would proceed from your point of view?
Sure. I mean, the question is one of straightforward statutory analysis. The statute 18-6801 and the succeeding sections are written very broadly. Mr. Romano has a concept in his mind that health care is what he conceives as traditional medical care, whereas the statute is written much more broadly. 6801 talks about treatment or acts by a healthcare provider. Now, a psychologist is admittedly a healthcare provider under the terms of the statute. A doctor doing a workman's compensation examination is obviously a healthcare provider. If he performs an act in connection with his professional duties as a healthcare provider, that brings him within the statute. And if he harms the person that he's examining in the independent medical exam context that Your Honor posited, he falls within the statute. And if he harms the patient as a result of that, the patient has a right of recovery under the statute if he follows its terms, which would include an affidavit of merit. And there's nothing in the statute that can be read explicitly or impliedly for the proposition that an independent healthcare provision is somehow not covered by the statute or not covered by the affidavit of merit provision. I mean, it's just not there. The statute talks about acts or treatments of a healthcare provider delivering healthcare. In this case, Dr. Romorowski, pursuant to a court order, examined Mr. Scalia, a psychological examination for custody purposes, his psychological fitness to care for his children. Those are the kinds of professional services that a psychologist renders. Mr. Romano hasn't pointed to any language in the statute, and I will, to explain why this wouldn't fall within the terms of the statute. The complaint on its face is labeled a malpractice action. In its body, it talks about acts of professional negligence. The question about what the pathonitary is supposed to do, by the terms of the statute, the pathonitary is supposed to reject any healthcare malpractice suit that doesn't have an affidavit of merit. In other words, it's not supposed to be docketed. That's what the statute says.
That's why I asked the question I did of Mr. Romano, because doesn't that make a significant difference that the pathonitary did not reject the lawsuit now? Because isn't Mr. Romano and his client now barred by statute of limitations from moving forward?
Well,
no chance to amend their complaint either?
Well, the statute of limitations bars this case in any event, but that's another issue. But as a practical matter, the pathonitaries, at least as far as I know, and I've asked this question a number of times, has never done what the statute says it's supposed to do, which is examine complaints. If they are alleging professional negligence and there's no affidavit attached, they are not rejecting them. Instead, what has happened, and the statute's been there now for 7 years, is that the pathonitary routinely dockets these complaints. The defendants routinely and automatically, in most cases, file motions to examine the affidavit of merit, which, of course, is what I did in this case, and that's how I learned that there was no affidavit of merit. And the courts then examined the affidavits of merit, and in some of the Superior Court decisions, what are purported to be affidavits of merit clearly were not affidavits of merit. They were letters written by people and things of that sort that you see in the decisions where the court has found that the threshold requirement was not met under the terms of the statute. But as far as I know, as a practical matter, the plenary is not screening these cases.
Well, and that may not be all bad.
No,
because if, you know, you've missed the statute of limitations, we have all sorts of collateral litigation about whether your mistake is attributable to court personnel. At least this way, if you're there, we know when you're there, and then people can file motions, as you've been saying.
Well, the difficulty is, at least arguably, that the plaintiff is not on notice that they needed an affidavit of merit, and they run afoul of the time frame in which they're allowed to file one.
Well, in this case, the plaintiff was on notice within 2 months of filing the complaint that it was an issue. And to this day, there was never any filing to extend the time to take advantage of the discretion that this court said existed under the Beckett versus Beebe case. None of that was ever done. I mean, this is not a case like Beckett where Justice Ridgely ruled that under the circumstances of that case, the Superior Court should have exercised discretion to allow an affidavit, which by that time had already been filed, and a motion to extend had already been filed. That's not this case, and the plaintiff isn't arguing on appeal that they should have been given additional time.
No, I understand that. I was just concerned that the statute mandates the prothonotary do X, and the prothonotary does not do X. Everywhere else in our small world, we tend to believe that people who work for the state follow the state statutes. But
well, I argued a case to this court 3 or 4 years ago involving one of the technical difficulties that Justice Holland alluded to, and the court in its wisdom reversed the dismissal of the case because of the technical issues about e-filing and whatnot. But I don't think that really comes into play here. This is a case where a psychologist who's licensed under Title 24, who comes under the rubric of 18 Delaware Code Section 68, provided professional services. A psychological exam is an act or a service. It comes within the term health care services and provisions of health care. It requires an affidavit of merit. One was not filed. One has never been filed. One doesn't exist as far as we know, and that's a fatal defect in a lawsuit of this nature. And I would suggest that the court can't change the statutory language and that has to follow it and apply it the way it's written. For that, I'd cite Leatherberry versus Greenspan.
Do you have any comment on the recusal issue?
Well, I didn't understand it when it was filed. I didn't understand it when it was argued. I still don't know what the letter is. I still don't know what Mr. Ramuno's supposed threat was. I jokingly said at the oral argument of this that if he apparently had threatened the judge's wife, who I happen to know, then I'd have to get out of the case. I don't know to this day what this is all about. All I know is that Judge Tolliver discussed it at the hearing and explained why, in his mind, it was no longer an issue and had long since ceased to be an issue. And I see nothing in what Mr. Ramuno's filed in this court that in any way undercuts that or disparages it.
Well, whether it does or doesn't, our standard of review is abuse of discretion, isn't it?
Certainly, yeah. And since I don't know anything about the underlying facts and Mr. Ramuno hasn't chosen to enlighten the court, I find it hard to understand how he can claim that there's an abuse of discretion over something that the judge has articulated was long moot by the time it came before him in July of 2009.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just briefly, as far as the argument that Dr. Romorowski performed psychological evaluations, that's incorrect. He did not perform psychological evaluations. Psychological evaluations were performed by someone else, an Erwin Foreman, and he was not involved in that part of it. So our issues are not necessarily involving the psychological evaluations. They weren't even performed by Dr. Romorowski.
So what did Dr. Romorowski do that your client disagrees with?
Well, there's, a number of issues. One of the issues is that the timing involved. He was supposed to be independent, but yet he met with the wife prior to being ordered. He also was retained initially by the wife for $5,000. He then collected $2,500 from my client, turned it to the wife. He also had interviews with the wife more extensively than with him. He interviewed all of wife's witnesses, but did not interview any of husband's witnesses. He basically, through his files, made an indication that he was communicating to a larger degree, more so than he was with my client. Once he testified, he was required to get another psychologist, Dr. Orloff, to basically go through this thing and contradict what Dr. Romorowski did, and his report is in there as well. And basically, I guess what he found was that there was bias and prejudice on the part of Mr. Romorowski as far as how he handled my client and the mother of the children.
So I take it, since the second psychologist was contradicting Romorowski, then neither of them did a psychological evaluation.
No, I think Domorowski did not do a himself. Some other doctor performed a psychological evaluation that basically he attached in his evaluation. Dr. Orloff did psychological evaluations as well, at least on my client. But really the issue as far as the psychological evaluations is really not the issue as far as the lawsuit. We're not arguing that. What we're arguing is the items as far as the bias, the prejudice, and so forth, not necessarily that he made any mistakes in administering or giving the test, because he did not, or evaluating the test.
So I guess Dr. Orloff could file an affidavit in this case if an affidavit was necessary and could still be filed.
He actually testified in family court with Dr. Romorowski in the court listening. He has also filed a report, which was filed and given to them and also attached in the appendix.
And the answer to Justice Holland's question, yes or no, is?
Well, presumably, I guess, his letter could be turned into an affidavit, I guess.
Well, there's a difference between reaching a different professional conclusion and saying that the professional conclusion you disagree with was the result of negligence, bias, or something else. So what would Dr. Orloff say, that he disagrees, or that Dr. Romanowski was biased or negligent?
From his letter, as I understand it, it's interpreted that he was biased and negligent, and that he basically treated the two differently.
Right. When did the dispute with Judge Tolliver's wife actually get resolved?
I know that the dispute was basically resolved sometime within a year. I'm not sure the exact date. I guess Judge Tolliver indicated that it was within the year of July, and that's probably accurate. But as far as what was going back and forth, money-wise, and I can explain it to the court if you want. I'm not sure how much you know.
No, I understand that. But just so I can understand the time frame, how many months or weeks prior to your motion had it been resolved?
I don't know the exact answer. I would say with my recollection was within about 6 months, within that time frame. But I can't, I'm guessing.
Okay.
Because I was not involved in that. That was with Norman Levin.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.